This is SG2 Perspectives, a conversation with industry experts and SG2 thought leaders about the biggest trends in healthcare and what we all expect that's going to mean for the future of healthcare delivery.
How many times have we all sort of wished that we could start from scratch? And although this isn't totally scratch, I think there's a lot of goodwill built up in the healthcare organizations right now. Use this goodwill to really rethink your future strategy.
Hello, and welcome to SG2 Perspectives. I am your host, Kelly Richard. Today, we'll be discussing how COVID-19 has increased urgency around health systems' role in addressing community health. Today, I have with me Carol Kapaski, Associate Principal on our Intelligence Team and leader of our Women and Children's Health Service Line, and Becca Siegel, Director of Client Relations. Becca has a public health background working with underserved populations in various spaces such as free clinics and think tanks focused on both informing policy and building effective programming. She's also out in the field speaking with our clients every day about their work addressing the social determinants of health. Thank you both for joining me.
Thank you for having us.
Great to be here.
So in full disclosure, Becca, Carol, and I work pretty closely together leading the work here at SG2 on all things community health improvement. So I'm probably going to weigh in a little more than usual on some of the content.
And Kelly has a background in global health and has worked in public health both globally and domestically, and also helps lead our value-based care intelligence.
Thanks, Becca. So let's get into it. So this is an incredibly timely moment to have this conversation. There's a lot to unpack here in terms of the fact that we're in the midst of a pandemic as well as widespread social unrest based on racially motivated police brutality. We're certainly going to focus here on COVID-19. We're seeing data showing that COVID-19 disproportionately impacts people of color. So what does that data gap look like? And what else is that data telling us?
Thanks, Kelly. I'll start here. But the beginning of this COVID-19 pandemic, a lot of people were saying that this was the great equalizer. And yes, this could be a threat to everybody. It is very clear from the data that that's not the case. The data that's been collected, it hasn't been collected uniformly. So as we are trying to better understand what that looks like state to state, what we do know is that Black mortality is almost 3.6 times that of white. And there are a lot of reasons for that. I think first, the underlying health conditions are more prevalent in those communities. We see this dramatically in New York City, where the COVID deaths topped 20,000 people. And in some wealthier zip codes, there was not even one death. Well, it was five times as likely in communities of color.
There's also a fascinating profile today in the Washington Post about Shreveport, Louisiana, and talking about the dearth of data connecting COVID infections to race really led to an inequitable distribution of testing sites. What we saw in most communities is that those testing sites emerged where there were hospitals and where there were more robust resources, often in suburban communities that were disproportionately white, versus those communities where we know that there are systemic health gaps already, and that those were places where testing access was set up much later. Kind of a reflection of some of the systemic disparities that are exacerbated by the COVID pandemic. We've spent a lot of time most recently thinking about the impact of COVID globally on our utilization projection, so our impact of change forecast that we build each year, and thinking about how economic disparities as well as coverage disparities also will lead to exacerbations, not only in treatment for COVID, but long-term changes in healthcare utilization. So kind of the ongoing economic crisis that we're in is disproportionately impacting low-income families. We know that those, as you were saying, Becca, those are the families that are on the front lines. Their jobs are also highly at risk. We also see that these are the communities that may disproportionately feel the effect of either under or uninsurance as the economy begins to suffer. So certainly we are anticipating Medicaid enrollment to grow, but we're also expecting the uninsured rate to grow as well. And that will disproportionately impact our low-income and minority communities.
Yeah, absolutely. And even when we're thinking about testing, something that kind of stands out to me is all of these organizations are talking about drive-through testing. And that's one of even just the most simple ways to think about it is that if you don't have a car, then you can't really do the drive-through testing. So I don't know that we're thinking about this as an industry in a way that's really very inclusive of the way people live in the different environments that they live in and what they have access to and don't have access to.
The context is really important because we have seen some folks leverage their mobile capabilities. So like repurposing mobile mammography units to now turn into mobile COVID testing sites, for example. But part of the advantage of the mobile is that they can go in many places. Part of the disadvantage of mobile is that they leave, right? They're not in a stationary place, and they may only be in a market for a limited amount of time. So it kind of at that tension between accessibility, but also consistency. These are part of those challenges that I think the COVID pandemic really revealed.
And you're sort of touching on trust, I think. So as you go into those communities, there's oftentimes a history of either distrust in the government and the healthcare community.
Yeah. And I think that's really related to a connection that we should probably make before we continue this conversation, which is that the effects of COVID-19 and these nationwide protests that are a response really to deep socioeconomic inequities in our country, the two events are not unrelated. So maybe it makes sense to sort of walk through some of the connections between those two things.
It's kind of marrying that need for healthcare systems to respond, right? There's this sense that we're in a recovery period. We need to start opening our doors again. We need to build that trust with our communities in general so that everybody feels safe to come back to the healthcare system and get their necessary healthcare services. Right? This is a topic I know we've been talking with all of our clients, both SG2 and Vizient. But thinking about what safe means to different communities, I think is going to be really important as we work to build that trust or capitalize on trust that we've built with the communities. And so I think one really poignant example is the idea of masks being symbols of safety. For some communities, and we're hearing from some of our patient and family advocacy boards that consistent masking is something that they're looking for in healthcare settings because that's a symbol of a consistent policy projecting safety to those patients. But if we're talking about communities of color and specifically Black men, is wearing a mask really a symbol of safety or is it actually a higher risk symbol for them? There could be a perception that this is going to increase their likelihood of being negatively stereotyped or even targeted by security or police in those healthcare settings. So the idea of what does safe mean to your different communities and building your policies in a culturally competent way to actually project a safe message that's inclusive to all of the communities that you serve is a great example of how we can put social determinants of health kind of at the forefront when we're thinking about how do we build in this recovery period and how do we ensure that we're serving all of the communities that we need to be serving in an equitable way.
The health systems that we work with have been impacted at varying degrees by COVID-19, and they're sort of in different stages of this crisis. Some still have a significant population of COVID-19 patients. I would say that many more are probably out of this crisis mode and are starting to ramp up their services again. And then there's others that have totally changed the way that they're thinking about strategy. They're sort of on to the next thing. In each of these phases, though, there are things that everyone should be thinking about in terms of addressing social determinants of health and better managing those vulnerable populations. What are some of the things that we think health systems really should be focusing on in order to work with their at-risk populations?
And I think there, it really comes back down to communication. A challenge early in the pandemic is having consistently delivered information, not just to your immediate patient community, but having that communication be culturally competent and really accessible by all the members of your community. Health systems, in many ways, earn a lot of goodwill and really become leaders in the COVID response. So kind of collaborating with public health entities and local government to build out what are those appropriate stabilization plans for our community. As we see health systems take that role, it becomes even more critical for them to recognize the different cultural needs and really the vulnerability of all the populations in the community. As we see health systems lead in the stabilized phase, it becomes even more critical for them to take a lead in caring for our people of color and disadvantaged populations.
So there may be some additional fears of those who are undocumented in either providing contact information or even accessing care. So make sure that those people who are doing outreach in the community make everybody feel safe and make everybody understand that this is a public health situation.
Right. And for the first time, we're really starting to see that if we fail to do those types of things, everyone in the community is affected. And that sort of might be the difference between the pre-COVID attitude regarding vulnerable populations and sort of the urgency to provide the communication and care and outreach that we're doing now, there's huge stakes here in terms of the entire community's health.
The data shows that those with underlying health conditions are much more likely to suffer either hospitalization or even death. Oftentimes, you as healthcare providers have that information at your disposal. So you could actually create registries of those patients that you serve and reach out to them directly and make sure that those people understand that they're at greater risk and ensure that they have the resources they need to stay safe.
What about some of the long-term strategies that health systems can put in place to not be hit as hard by this in the future?
I think that a lot of the healthcare systems that I work with have already begun these strategies, right? So just like we saw virtual health accelerate by about 5 years, I think that now is really a pivotal moment where you could use this opportunity to continue building the partnerships and the relationships that you have in the community. I think if anything, what's happening right now has taught everybody to listen to the community about what they need and what you as a healthcare provider can do to make people feel safe and welcome into your facilities. I had the opportunity to sit at a conference this week where the CEO of Intermountain spoke, and he said, doing the right thing is also usually the right thing for business. And I think that that's really important to remember. So as you're figuring out how to move through this and what community resources are needed, have a seat at the table and don't necessarily be the head of that table, and make sure that all of those community-based organizations and the government entities all feel like they have an equal voice. And that's the only way to move through this public health crisis, coupled with the economic crisis, coupled with everything else that's happening right now. It's really, really important to have those partnerships and relationships as strong as possible.
We can also begin to anticipate what are some of the clinical implications as well. So knowing how important those partnerships will be, because we can anticipate certain aspects of healthcare to really accelerate as a result of this. So putting my pediatrics hat on, thinking about the impact of long-term stress on children. We also are seeing things like food insecurity being a problem as schools close. So thinking about what are some of the longer-term impacts of that stress that's going to be uniquely faced by children in underserved communities, as well as thinking through what are some of the kind of systemic planning that we would need to do in the long term to prevent that kind of stress from happening again to pediatric patients in particular. On a clinical note, there was just a study that came out from France that actually shows there may be a clinical difference between children of African descent versus those from kind of other ethnic backgrounds that may predispose them for the Kawasaki-like inflammatory condition that we're seeing emerge about a month after in pediatric patients. So there are going to be long-term clinical issues that have arisen either from a mental health or a systemic stress perspective. But we're also seeing that it may reveal some genetic disposition to negative outcomes from this disease as well. So it's important not only with our partnership and our community hat on, but even with our clinical hat on, there are disparities that we are going to be facing that we'll need to be planning for in the long term.
So another way that COVID-19 has really illuminated our health system's weaknesses has been the financial hit sustained by healthcare providers. Our system really does thrive on commercial payment and procedures. Elective procedures were all but halted, and our hospitals admitted thousands of medical cases, which they never really make any money on, for COVID-19. A lot of these patients were chronically ill or they had multiple comorbidities. So, and this is kind of a question to all of you, do you think that adopting other payment models could better insulate health systems and providers from events like this and also better take care of these high-risk patient populations?
Absolutely. Like, we certainly saw that the financial impact of COVID on our health systems and on providers was also not uniform. There was an analysis that came out, I think, early in the pandemic that really showcased the risk that public hospitals were facing compared to some of our larger IDNs who had more cash on hand. So we saw that the public hospital system really was at risk. And knowing that also many of our independent providers, our practices are really struggling. And if we think about who are those kind of frontline healthcare workers that are really essential for building those community relationships and reaching out to our disadvantaged populations. A lot of that work falls on our primary care providers, especially those clinics in disadvantaged communities. And we saw that a lot of the financial recovery funding may have bypassed a lot of those practices. So I think what this revealed is that the fee-for-service model favors those health systems and providers who are already more financially solvent, and that there may be a benefit to rethinking what is a new payment model or a prospective payment model or per member per month type model that could be beneficial to kind of keeping doors open without being reliant on getting those elective procedures back in the door. Kelly, I know you're definitely the expert here, so I'd love to hear what you're thinking.
I kind of go back to what Becca said earlier in terms of usually what's right for business is also the right thing to do. And I think that that hasn't necessarily always been the case of fee-for-service, but you have to consider that fee-for-service medicine or management of lives and the way that that business model works doesn't necessarily produce better health outcomes. So when we're thinking about how to get a better health baseline for population health management, where you know, you're relying on a lot of preventive services to improve general health. You're rewarding physicians and providers in general for getting better health outcomes. That is more in line with sort of what is right for patients and what is right for healthcare or what is right for their health. But also, I think something that we're going to hear a lot of when we're thinking through whether or not we want to change business models at this time is that there are a lot of systems that are in value-based care. And I, if you could see me, I would have my fingers in quotations here, value-based care, because a lot of it is just some sort of shared savings or shared risk model laying on top of a fee-for-service model. They don't have the infrastructure set up to truly practice population health. So they're really sort of just going part of the way there. And they aren't going to reap the benefits of the prospective payment that a true capitation model might get. I would caution folks to say, give up on value-based care. We don't have the time to deal with it, or you know, it's not working because we had some shared risk agreement or shared savings agreement that didn't work. If you want to look at more mature systems, we'd probably get a better idea as to whether or not they're faring better or worse. And Intermountain probably has a bit more in the way of risk, and the fact that they're doing better might be a better indication than some of the organizations that are only part of the way there at this point. One way that we have different organizations that are already experiencing capitation is when you think about their vulnerable populations that are non-paying. So they're already coming into the emergency department, and health systems are essentially at risk for those patients already. All of the services they get is just money that they lose. So if we're thinking about getting better managing those populations according to some sort of a risk model, I think most organizations are already having some practice at doing that, whether they like that or not. And the other thing to keep in mind is that that population, based on the economy right now and the number of unemployed people and the growing uninsured population, that means that the population of people that are non-paying that hospitals are going to be quote unquote at risk for is growing.
I love that concept, Kelly, that, and it was really built out by our counterparts at the Vizient Research Institute this year. And we featured some of their analysis in the recent Social Determinants of Health publication that came out at SG2 in March, really focusing on that idea of building a risk contract with yourself for some of those at-risk populations, because you're already on the hook for the cost. So what can you be doing to mitigate that cost? And especially right now, with the financial strait that most health systems and hospitals are facing, now is absolutely the time to be thinking about how can I mitigate my costs and rethink how I emphasize preventative wellness and prevention of that inpatient stay for those at-risk populations.
And I think it's also really important as we dive into health justice, which is looking at the links between racial disparities and income disparities and health outcomes, that you as a healthcare provider think seriously about what you can do to drive the economic vitality in your communities, which will no doubt improve your health outcomes. So whether that means hire local, bring businesses to the community, you know, make sure that your suppliers are local or minority owned, these are all important things to consider. I know Vizient tracks affects this, which is wonderful. So there's a way to think beyond the social determinants of health, which these are known as the structural determinants of health, that are no longer sort of this band-aid, these pilot programs, but will have long-term lasting effects, which, if anything, is the lesson that we can take away from this current crisis. And it's really a moment to think and think towards the future about what you can do to make this lasting change and make it a better, equitable society for your patients and community.
Right. And Becca, it's kind of interesting that you say that because I've talked to a couple of different organizations that have been thinking that way already. So I spoke to one organization, and to be honest, I was actually pretty surprised by this. But basically, what this executive told me was that they were kind of skipping past some of these value-based care contracts and going straight to investment in the community instead. They had sort of a small market. It might be a little bit different when, you know, you have a small market and you kind of know where your investments are going. It's easier to track, which is always sort of a challenge. But their idea was to just go even further upstream than the value-based care and just sort of increasing the economic vitality, as you said, in the community by investing in education. And, you know, some of these organizations purchase buildings in their neighborhoods to, you know, lease to businesses, or they get involved in housing. And that was kind of the direction that they were going in. So I think that's even more emphasized as being a potential option for investment versus just the more traditional way of looking at ROI. And even though this sort of ROI is much more difficult to measure.
But I think that, like, it helps to tee up the idea of taking this moment and looking for opportunities as opposed to just kind of thinking through what are those challenges. I think that what it also reveals is some unique opportunities to rethink. Is this the time to pull out our traditional value-based care playbook and just, you know, try to change the business model from fee-for-service to capitated payment? Is that really how we want to use this opportunity? Or do we want to take it as an opportunity to rethink the care delivery path and maybe take the time to really think if we have this opportunity to rebuild anew in kind of an entirely new landscape, we have that license to truly be creative. There are some unique opportunities that we could be building toward that just have social determinants of health at the core from the beginning. So maybe if we can think about the post-pandemic period as a new beginning where we have that opportunity to really focus in on how are we going to deploy these new care delivery pathways? Things I'm thinking right now, thinking virtual, because that's top of mind for us when we were thinking about forecasting. How is that going to fundamentally change how we deliver healthcare? You know, if we're projecting right now that about 40% of in-person visits are going to go away in 10 years, and most of that loss is happening in the first 3 or 4, that's a radical change in how we deliver care. But we can't make that change equitably without considering what are the challenges to delivering care virtually in our disadvantaged communities within our market. How do we build the infrastructure ensuring that there's broadband access in every household in my community? How do I ensure that the necessary diagnostic devices are being distributed equitably? Like, do I have the ability to get some of the Bluetooth-enabled diagnostic tools to these communities in a safe way? What do I need to accommodate, or what do I need to be thinking about in the actual interface? Is there a video platform, or is there an approach or a script that I should be building that allows for us to incorporate cultural competence into these communications? Let's build that script in a culturally competent way from day one, since we have that opportunity to think of now as a beginning. When I look out, I see a lot of opportunity to take away from this time.
That's exactly right, Carol. How many times have we all sort of wished that we could start from scratch? And although this isn't totally scratch, I think there's a lot of goodwill built up in the healthcare organizations right now. Use this goodwill to really rethink your future strategy. So whether that's the virtual visits or your partnerships, listening to your community, rethinking your payment models.
I'll say another favorite example of mine is thinking about, as we shift to AI tools, did we plan for those tools to be accessible in multiple languages, in the languages that are in our community? Did we program that algorithm in ways that are incorporating data from all the communities of color within our care path or within our service area? I actually remember on a early podcast talking about how can we leverage these AI-enabled tools to really rapidly extend information and care to all sorts of communities without having folks come in. But we're developing all of those tools in English and training them on probably not diverse data sets.
Absolutely. And I would say, too, that for most of the systems in the country, they're mostly nonprofit and they have missions that are really dedicated to caring for their communities and everyone in them. So doing things differently is really not that much of a departure from what the original values of that organization have been. If anything, maybe we've departed a little bit from them trying to survive in the fee-for-service environment. And that's not to say that there isn't a ton of really amazing work going on with all of these health systems. I think that that's certainly true, but I also believe that there's a lot of pressures that they're experiencing that may not be in complete congruence with following their mission. So this actually may be an opportunity to get a little closer to what that mission is and what all of the people that work in these health systems really come into work to do at the end of the day.
How many of you listening had been saying, we can't do virtual health, we don't have the technology, the doctors won't get on board? And then all of a sudden, you go from 10 visits a month to, you know, 7,000, basically overnight. When in a time of crisis, you can change and you can accelerate that change so fast, let's think strategically about what other changes might be needed, because this is the time to do it.
Right. We've performed so well in making changes overnight that it's sort of difficult to make the argument that we can't do something differently, because we certainly have the capability. And I think that that might be a great way to end this is really on a positive note of not only do we have the ability to do these things, but the urgency to make these changes is greater than ever. Well, thank you, Carol and Becca, for joining me today. If you like what you're hearing, please also listen and subscribe to our colleague, Dr. Tom Villanueva's Modern Practice podcast on Vizient's Medical Leadership Channel. Tom discusses key healthcare trends through the clinical leadership lens. You can find it wherever you listen to podcasts. Thank you for listening and stay healthy.
This has been another great episode of SG2 Perspectives, where industry experts and SG2 thought leaders explore the drivers of tomorrow's healthcare strategies to inform today's decision makers. Contact us anytime by sending an email to sg2perspectives@sg2.com. We'd love to hear from you. SG2 revolutionized healthcare demand forecasting with the Impact of Change forecast, and today, we're the industry's premier strategy advisory firm. To learn more, visit sg2.com. Thanks so much for listening, and we'll see you again soon.